everything from my background and always having to find myself in big groups of people, I've had to find belonging wherever I've gone. So when I'm in a space with a whole bunch of humans, it's natural to me to do my very best to make sure that they feel safe in that space and that they belong in that space. In terms of belonging, facilitation is key, because that is someone with intent who is making sure that everybody is seen, heard, you know, feeling proud and connected and supported through whatever you're doing.
Welcome to Create Belonging. My name is Matteo Bornico, and this is the podcast where we explore the world through the lens of belonging. It's great to be back, and today I'm actually having a bit of a sore throat and probably catching a cold, so that's why I may sound a little bit off today, but I hope you can forgive me. This episode is about creativity. And creativity is really important for belonging, because creativity is one of the keys to belong. Creativity is about taking action. And we all have the potential to be creative. And in many ways, creativity is something that is deeply human. And if we're trying to discover our belonging, or if we're trying to help others belong, then creativity is one of the necessary skills that we will need. And when it comes to understanding how creativity can be used for belonging, I knew that I wanted to speak to Jenny Teolin. Jenny Teolin is a renowned expert who helps people learn more effectively. Jenny has a wealth of experience from around the world and a background in design. And with it, she creates effective, engaging, and memorable learning experiences for organizations, schools, and nonprofits. Jenny's latest project is a book called Dare to Facilitate. It's a collection of dares gathered from facilitators from all over the globe in order to help just about anyone tap into the power of facilitation. This was a very fun conversation that just flowed. Of course, we look into what facilitation is and how it can be used to create belonging. Jenny talks about her backstory and what it was like growing up as the child of Swedish diplomats. And apart from the topics I just mentioned, we also look into the importance of courage and why we could all benefit from daring just a little bit more. If you get to listen towards the end, we get into the nitty-gritty of belonging. So I dare you. No, I double dare you to listen to my conversation with the one, the only, the super fun and creative Jenny Teolin. Jenny, welcome to Great Belonging.
Thank you so much.
How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. I'm surprisingly awake, considering that my daughter likes to keep us up at night. She's nearly two now. Yeah. I feel good. I feel energized and ready.
Good. You told me also that you were pretty busy. You're right now about to launch your book as well, which we'll definitely get on to it a little bit later in the conversation. But how are you doing coping with the book launch and everything else?
It's getting there. It's last week I suffered from creative paralysis, where it was just, there's just too many ideas in my head. And for those of you who've seen some of this work, it's very creative and colorful, and it was just a lot. And I just sort of gave up and watched Netflix and went to the gym and then started over again. Because when you get a concept that can spin off in so many different areas and you have a creative mind, it's actually a challenge to kind of rein in and just to think, well, actually, what's important right now and what do I prioritize right now? Because, yeah, there's quite a lot of stuff that I still want to do. Yeah.
And I think it's pretty easy to say that creativity is one of your superpowers, if not your main superpower. And perhaps one of the most remarkable or creative things that you've done is you put on a LOL cat show in London. Can you take us back there and yeah, paint a yes. picture for us? What is the LOL cat show?
So the LOL cat exhibition, imagine this, 49 artists, creatives, photographers, all having to had the privilege, I would say, to reimagine internet cat memes in their artwork. This was an exhibition that I did in 2014. One of the main reasons why I did it in the first place was I was getting into this time of my life where I'd been working at design agencies for a good 8-9 years, and I was noticing so many of my colleagues were kind of trapped in their own creativity. They were all employed to do certain things, but then they all had other superpowers like photography or music or fashion design. So I started a business. I left the design industry and I started a business called Soapbox and Sons, which was sort of an events and an experience company, experiential company. And LOLCAT was my second exhibition. The first one was actually called Alienation, The Art of Blending In. And it was all about internationals in London, moving to London, based on a book by George Mikesh called How to Be an Alien, which is very funny. We'll put it in the show notes because it's from the 40s and it's an amazing book. Anywho, so the LOLCAT thing, what was so interesting about that was that it was actually marrying the sort of cats, everybody loves cats, and trust me, like from a PR perspective, just include cats and it's golden. You know, this was featured on the BBC, on the Independent, BuzzFeed, everywhere, even in Sweden, Dagens Nyheter and Feber. But like the depth of it was LOL speak as a communication style. And I had a researcher from Microsoft fly over from the States because she had written a dissertation in LOL speak. Yep. And so she sort of introduced us to this where you're working in a big corporate company and you can't really email your work BFF, you know, complaining about the boss. But if you send a cat meme of Grumpy Cat, you know, she might automatically know what you're trying to say without saying it. So there's a whole level of like, how can internet memes, in this case cats, be a way of communicating?
Wow. And that's called LOL speak?
That's called LOL speak, yeah.
Well, I didn't know I was fluent in LOL speak.
See?
I love it.
Yeah.
Wow. And so this, the way you presented this was how many creatives you said took part in this?
There's 49 pieces.
49.
Yeah.
And so you were the I guess the instigator, the driving force. You created that space.
Yes.
For these creatives to come back. And in a way, this art show, this art exhibition was perhaps even the first one you talked about alienation. It was a way for you to help others belong and find their belonging, which it's a very generous act. And so I'm pretty sure that people to this day, like we are today, they're still talking about it. And within these confines of having an art exhibition and so on, you managed to create belonging for others. So
for sure. Yeah. I think the interesting part is, you know, you create a concept or, you know, even it could be a pledge. It could be something that other people want to be included in and standing by. And in these cases and other, I've put on, I think, about 17 art and design and photography exhibitions. And in every instance, it's showcasing others in a different light. I think, you know, embracing the role of a curator in everything that you do, talking about, you know, being generous with providing a space or a platform, or in my case was a soapbox, you know, that is that's something that you can bring into sort of any working field. Like, how can you create or collect people, ideas and thoughts and showcase those? I think that's quite a powerful tool to use.
In many ways, it seems that there were probably elements in your personal life that made it easy for you to relate to these things. So where did you start? Well, how was your journey that led you to London? Like, I know that you're Swedish, but you are not in many ways. So tell me a little bit about young Jenny.
So it started on the 18th of August, 1982. 83, actually. We moved to Japan, to Tokyo, and my parents are now retired diplomats. So I was traveling all my childhood and teens up until I was 19 when I actually moved to London. And during that time, very seldom were we in the same place for more than 3 years. So it was a constant sort of flip and a constant, you know, redesigning your life. One thing that I now in retrospect have noticed that really helped me in grounding myself through these sort of adventures and travels is that my parents, they actually had the same furniture in every place that we lived. So a lot of other diplomats, they might rent furniture or they use somebody else's, like in the residencies. But my parents actually moved all our stuff. So every bedroom I've had have still felt like it was my room because it had my bed. And even today, you know, they have a lot of the same furniture in their house as retirees? Pensioners that they did in the 80s and 90s. So it wasn't just about leaving every place. It was just as much about arriving. And every time I arrived at a new location, it was, you know, new city, new culture, new language, new food. And I had to very quickly learn how to adapt and integrate into those societies. And in some instances, it was more around sort of the community, the international community and the school community. But as I grew older and more brave, I ventured into the local communities. And I actually, the final stop before London was Istanbul, where I finished my international baccalaureate. And most of my friends there were local Turks, not you know, friends from in my, I mean, my classes were only 11 people,
yeah.
But still, some of those are still friends to this day. But yeah, so.
I'm going to take a guess that you became pretty good at understanding different cultures, at getting, understanding the nuances between different cultures, having a very kind of like a spider sense when it comes to what you like and not like about a place, and also it's cultural intelligence, I guess, what I'm getting at.
Yeah. I had to.
Yeah.
Also because I knew that I had a finite time. And this was also a beauty in it because I knew there was an end date. Yeah. So I knew that I had 2-3 years. Obviously, that intelligence became bigger and better the older I got. And obviously, in the younger ages, it was very difficult to leave my friends. You know, at a certain time in your life, in your teens, they mean, you know, everything to you. What it also really helped was I really found out who my real friends were. Because by leaving, it was the ones that I would still sort of maintain contact with and in touch with. And that all changed when Facebook came, because then I could also find long lost people. Not that I'm on Facebook today and not that I still talk to them, but still at that time, in that bubble of time, it was really good for me.
Yeah, I guess now also with Facebook and other social media, there's no more excuses. It's like, I lost your phone number.
Yeah.
Or, I, you know, lost touch now.
But now, I'm not on Facebook. What, you're on Facebook? Surely that's for the older generation.
Yes, exactly. We just definitely
not
did it.
Ageist at all.
yeah, exactly. All right, so how comfortable are you with the term citizen of the world? You're a global citizen. You know, what was that? How do
yeah,
you?
Yeah, I, I would say that. I would say I was that more than I am feeling it now. There's another term, third culture kid,
yeah,
which is also something that's used for people like me, where there's, you know, an external culture, and then there's the where you're from, and then there's your family culture in that place. So that's been an experience. But I would have to say that representing Sweden, you know, my father was consulate general and then ambassador, and every time we had a reception or there was a Swedish celebration, you know, so I have never been more Swedish than I was when I lived outside of Sweden.
Right. Yeah.
Which is also interesting.
And you ended up in London. Perhaps not a coincidence that London is one of those, alongside New York and it's just one of the most diverse, like, melting pots of cities. And you studied design, and I guess by now you probably knew you were, let's say, I'm doing air quotes here, a creative person. So what does it mean to you to be a creative?
What does it mean to be a creative? In hindsight, I made a pivotal mistake when I moved to London, because I got an offer to do design studies and business. But as soon as I arrived, I dropped the business. I went, I'm a designer. I just want to be creative. Bad, Jenny. I wish I had kept that, because what I didn't know then at the time was that a lot of my creative energy was to be spent on building creative businesses or creative concepts or products or services. At that time, I was very focused on the what I would be doing and not how I would be doing it and how I would get it to fly and go to market. So that was a big mistake. But creativity to me is it's like John Cleese says, you know, it's not a talent, it's a way of operating. And for me, it is a way of being. It's how I come up with ideas. It's what allows me to experiment and test and not be afraid of pushing ideas out into the world. And I think there's a lot of ideas flying around. And I remember a few times when I've had some of those ideas and thought, you know, like, this is not an original idea. It's like, well, Jenny, what's not original is that no one's actually done it.
Yeah.
So it was a lot of, like, creativity to me means kind of a way of being and a philosophy and also a methodology that I'm a creator and maker, making things manifest. That's how I see my creativity.
Absolutely. I think one of the things that's really remarkable about you is that you are, aside from being highly skilled and talented and all those things that are great for creativity, you're also really good at getting things done. You have these ideas and you take action, which is pretty amazing. And it's like how we started the conversation, that you were having a creativity, you were stuck.
Paralysis.
Yeah. But you know that is temporary. You know better to go for a walk, change tracks, mm-hmm. and then you trust that your creativity eventually will lead you to action. So
exactly. And I think you can be creative with a lot of different things as well. I mean, going back to the Lolcat exhibition, we got a quite unfavorable review. An art critic came from The Independent, and I wasn't there, unfortunately, because I got sick sort of the day after the launch. But he went down there with his team and he wrote this piece. And I think the headline was "Not So Many Lols at Lolcat." And I'm just like, Jesus, he has no humor. What's wrong with him? So what I did was I wrote a piece where I basically asked the Lolcat community. I shared the article everywhere.
Yeah.
And I said, well, you know, look, we're in The Independent, double page spread, full color. Your art pieces are in there. Just ignore everything that he writes.
Right.
They started sending me cat memes of him as Grumpy Cat. And I think I got around at least 20. So I wrote a blog piece and I said, thank you, Tom Peck, for all the lols that you've given this show. Day later, his editor-in-chief calls me on the telephone and says, I saw your homage to our journalist. Would you mind if we printed those in Next? weeks special.
Yes.
Of course. And then the day before I get, so the journalist, Tom, he sends me the clipping and he goes, one for our scrapbooks. And it said, what it feels like to be savaged by the lolcat community. And he apologized. He noted that, you know, everything was for charity as well. I gave the proceeds to Betsy Cats and Dogs Home. And, you know, when, like, maybe I was a little bit harsh. And that's creativity, too. It's like taking something that you could just be really upset about, you know, some high-flying art critic giving you negative feedback. But we made it a fun thing. And actually, the last thing we did in that little thread was we framed the last piece and put it in the exhibition. So he became part of the exhibition that he hated so much.
Wow. This is so great. It's like she who laughs last laughs
exactly,
best.
Exactly, exactly. Creative revenge.
Yes. Wow.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
All PR is good PR.
But you're not in London anymore.
I'm not, no.
No, we're sitting here in Stockholm.
Yep.
And you've been back to your native land, as they say.
9 years.
Wow. Yeah.
I mean, London was 14, so that's been my record.
Right.
But I've surpassed my record in relationships because Patrick got married too. Before Patrick, you know, I think my longest relationship was around 5 years. And we're in the year 8.
Wow.
I think.
Wow. So you met him after you've moved?
Yeah. Yeah. And my first Swedish partner as well.
Wow.
Which was also new. Because I only knew the language of love in English. So, you know, something I had to learn. But moving to Sweden was actually more challenging than I thought it was going to be. Because originally I thought, oh, I can't move sort of back home. It feels like I'm giving up kind of on the international lifestyle. It's like, oh, I'm going. It felt like I was going back.
Right.
But I was going forward. And arriving, I also very quickly realized I was not stereotypically Swedish. And this is someone, you know, I've been living extremely Swedish internationally. So that was very interesting. So what I did then during my first sort of 6 months was, okay, I need to sort of reclaim my Swedishness. And somebody, I don't know who, nominated me to Curators of Sweden, the Twitter account. So I got to tweet as Sweden. And that was fun because friends in London were like, Jenny moves to Sweden. Jenny becomes Sweden. Yep. So I did that. And then I was voted into the Board of Design Sweden, which is unfortunately, it's not with us anymore, a membership organization. I did an event called Swedish Production, where I invited Swedish production houses to come and showcase their work. Basically, anything with the word Sweden in it.
Yeah, you became Sweden, as your friend said. Wow.
Yes. So there was a whole... I wrote for two guidebooks on the startup guides. I wrote the foreword to it, like an expert on Sweden. And then I wrote a guide. It's a creative series called City Times 60. And they have a book on Stockholm, and it was like giving advice on where to go and stuff. So yeah, it was Sweden, 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 Sweden until I felt like, okay, I feel justified now being here.
Wow.
Mm.
But yet there was something...
I think professionally, it's still a very big challenge. I mean, it is challenging because... very often I'm the creative wild card. I'm like, oh, she's interesting. Oh, but then, you know, the lovely, lovely Sweden, you know, nepotism and, oh, it's my best friend's uncle's daughter. She got the job kind of situations. I'm assuming. So in the beginning, when I was sort of, shall I continue being an independent freelancer? Shall I start a Swedish company, which I then did? Or shall I find... a job somewhere, and I noticed very soon that I didn't fit the mold for employment in Sweden.
Yeah,
because I had my, you know, wild and wacky ideas which could not be contained.
Right.
Which is where I am sort of today as well. I think creativity is very scary for a lot of people. I think bold ideas and daring to do things differently and testing and experimenting, you know, my view on Sweden is a lot more considered and planned, and you know, don't really have the space for the fringes in the same way as London would, because in London everybody was on the fringe.
And rightfully so, I think. You know, Sweden is, what's that word I'm looking for? Like, it goes over many generations. Anyways,
traditional?
Yeah, very, very traditional, stable, mm-hmm. predictable.
Predictable.
And creativity doesn't fit that mold. Mm. And
having said that, though, I mean, Stockholm, I'm in the right place, because there's still design and innovation, and you know, just look at the whole startup world. I think my challenge, which also is my niche, is working with the traditional, old school, established businesses in becoming more creative and becoming more innovative. Or else, you know, the time is kind of ticking, which is a catch-22. Because if I work with the smaller, more creative companies, which I also do, but maybe not to the same extent, it's a language that we all speak. So, for example, one of my first projects in Stockholm was working with Hyper Island, where I was program lead for the part-time master's degree. I was asked to launch it in Stockholm. And funnily enough, the Stockholm launch didn't really happen as planned, and I had to take that cohort to London once a month for 10 months. And I was like, hang on a minute, I've just moved to Stockholm and now I'm going back to London. My friends were very confused in London. It's like, what are you doing here again? Anyway, working within education with Hyper Island, with Brooke School of Communication, with Shillington College in London, they're very ahead of the times. You know, our job as educators is to prepare these learners for the future. Unfortunately, a lot of businesses aren't there yet.
Yeah.
So coming out of that bubble, whether you're a student or whether you're a program manager, a court designer, or a keynote speaker, you know, I find myself either forever sort of being in the inspirational speaker sphere, because they're not ready to act on the practical side of things.
They're willing to listen.
And to I was like, oh, that was so inspiring, and I loved your shoes. But they're not willing to put the work down.
Right.
Which is what I want them to do.
Yes.
Come on.
Which gets to today and the work you're doing, helping companies embrace creativity, and you do facilitation. Can you explain to me what facilitation is for those that don't know?
Yes, of course I can. So facilitation, coming from French and Latin, facilis, taking something very complex and breaking it down and making it simple. That's sort of my simplest explanation, but most of the time is that you're guiding a group of individuals toward a shared goal. And that you can make creative, you design those experiences, and facilitation is really one of the sort of practical things I do in creating learning experiences. So it kind of leads into that, but it's a skill on its own, and it's a role on its own. There are so many different types of facilitators, and actually the ones I've met, I've never met two that are alike. The first time I met two facilitators was on a project in the UK that I was helping create. It's called Medal. It was a wonderful man called Ted Perlman from, I think it was from Canada or the States. Don't hate me if you're listening. He gathered a group of people in a cottage in the Cotswolds. And it wasn't just any ordinary group of people. He gathered Jessica Hirsch, who's a typographer extraordinaire. He gathered Eugen Merman from Flight of the Conchords. We had a private chef. We had the dollhouse restorer for the Queen. Group of people to work on a project together, and it was called Metal, and I was there sort of as a creative director and helped just, yeah, make the whole thing happen. And he had invited two facilitators from Microsoft, again, Microsoft, to come and facilitate us, which they unfortunately couldn't.
Right.
I shared a room with one and she was crying in the evenings because what happens when you gather a group of rock stars? It was, yeah, I played a part. The last day, I was just like, you can beep this. Fuck this shit.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm
yeah.
going to the pub. Who's
yeah.
with me?
Yeah.
But that was really, really interesting because I'd never heard the word facilitator. And I was like, what are they? Why are they making us like
yeah,
do things?
Yeah.
Like, why do I have to answer that question? That's really banal question.
Yeah, don't try to box me.
Don't, exactly.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, do you know who I am?
But
that was my first experience
yeah.
with it, which is interesting because
right.
that's, you know, not how it should be.
No.
No.
Wow. But, I mean, what were they thinking if you get all these, like, counterculture, like,
I know.
People?
I don't know. It wasn't a very... Ted was very good at bringing great people together. And my friend Mike, who invited me onto the project, he was what we called the middle meddler. So he brought a brief to that we were all going to sort of help and solve. And the brief was actually close to my heart, which was, how can we help individuals with their passion projects? How can their passion projects come to life? And the biggest insight that I got during that whole event was from Daniel Bull, who designed the logo and worked with me on it. He said, but Jenny, like, the whole thing is actually a bit flawed. And I was like, why is that? Well, passion projects are the things that you do regardless. Like, those are they are the things that you do whether you don't have any money, you know. That's a passion. Everything else might be like something that you enjoy or interests, or, you know, you have to make a business out of it. But passion, you know, you don't need any help.
That,
which is really interesting to me.
Yeah, this reminds me of a talk I heard from Elizabeth Gilbert, the writer. And she makes a clear distinction between a hobby and a calling.
Ah.
And for her, writing was her calling.
Yeah.
It wasn't a hobby. She regards gardening or cooking as a hobby. Mm. But writing was for her, her calling.
Yeah,
and so
she would do it anyway,
whether
yeah.
she gets paid or
yeah.
not, whether
yeah.
it's she doesn't feel like it, she would still write
yeah.
it. There's a voice whispering in her mm. ear that this is what she needs to mm. do. Of course, very few of us are lucky enough to follow our calling that eventually leads to a career.
Mm.
And she also makes a distinction between a career and a job.
Yeah.
So everybody needs a job. Everybody needs to make a living. And hopefully everybody will have a calling and a hobby, but not everybody needs a career not everybody's job is a career.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a distinction
well,
to be made.
Imagine all the musicians who work in bars. I mean,
yeah,
that
exactly.
makes total sense.
Yeah.
But I would also say that, I mean, I consider my photography being a hobby.
Yeah.
But I still do it anyway, regardless. But I do say no to commissions. I sell through galleries and my photography book. But that's like, I've taken these pictures. If you like them, of course you can buy them.
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm not going to stop you buying them. But it's not going to be, Jenny, can you go and take photographs of this park for our brochure?
Right.
I think that's also something that you can sort of define. Like, okay, some things I just... I don't need to make this into a money-making machine. I can just do it. And then hopefully the people who like what I'm doing will come and buy it. But that, yeah.
Yeah.
I actually really like saying no as well.
Yeah.
It's like, no. And during, actually, talking about photography, during my maternity leave, my daughter had a colic for 4 months. So I basically just walked with her in the pram. And I was, going out of my mind because I had something to do. And that's when I kicked off an idea called Photo Lunch, where I photographed people over lunch and they bought me lunch. And that was also a really nice thing to do, photographing people. And in some cases, I made it an experience. So I had one who was a former student of mine who didn't know Stockholm very well. And I asked her, like, what do you like? And, and I said, do you like secondhand clothes? Do you like vegan food? Do you like that? And we actually made a little sort of walking tour on the Odenplan, where I photographed her some portraits and then went to a secondhand shop and then photographed some more. And it was just a really nice day. And I wouldn't, you know, I would never charge for those photos. It's like, here you go. And that kept me going those months. So I think I had 8 or something in total.
There is an act of generosity there. And so it is kind of a red thread in your creative work. Not only are you creative, but also a lot of your creative work is an act of generosity. So whether it's providing space for those back in London and both for the Alienation and the Lolcat exhibition and with your photography project, of course, which leads us to your book that you're currently publishing. Mm. And it's self-published, I believe?
It's self-published. Okay. I didn't have time. Okay. I'm just going to do it all myself.
Yeah. And it's a beautiful book. I've seen much of it. I have yet to hold it in my hands, mm-hmm. but I'm sure that moment will come soon. Tell me about this book. And we covered what facilitation is, but since you said you've never met two facilitators that are the same, you managed to create a collection of facilitators. Mm-hmm. And your book, There to Facilitate, is, it seems that it's an expose of the different types of facilitators, the different dimensions of facilitation. Can you tell me a little bit more about that project?
Yeah, of course. So first, there's a lot of things sort of the past few years that have been brewing in terms of, I've never thought that I would write a book, and especially not, and I would say create a book, because I've not written this whole book, but create a book concept that's not just me writing about stuff that I already know, because I would get extremely bored very fast. So it had to be a project that would, I would learn new things, but that would also be creative, that would also sort of be part of how I do things in terms of, you know, even at Hyper Island, as a program manager, I would curate guest speakers, and I've, you know, done loads of programming. The same way as I do with exhibitions, I wanted it to be a collection of voices instead of just mine. Also because, like, I wouldn't say that I am the biggest expert on facilitation. I know it from my experience and, you know, all the workshops that I've run, but, you know, I'm still relatively new in the game if you look at some people. So I thought it would be a fun project to do. And the whole sort of truth or dare concept was actually cemented when I was visiting my brother, because she'll be so embarrassed for me saying this. Actually, I wrote it in the book as well, so she'll be embarrassed about that too. His daughter, who's 7, came home from school and she told us that she had had her first kiss.
Wow.
So we interrogated her. It's like, oh, how did that happen? And she, in the coolest of tones, just said, well, you know, we were just playing dare or dare. And I went, oh, you're really setting it up for success there.
Yeah. Wow.
Which was absolutely amazing. So that, you know, that started my, okay, dare to, well, let's, you know, if I really want to start kicking people and businesses up the bum, I need to get more aggressive. How can I do that in my way? So that's where the dares have come from. And the book is it spans 320 pages, so it's quite a thick book. And there's lots of space, though. It's a very sort of easy bite-sized read. And there's 30 chapters all sort of where I've identified an area. So things like dare to include, dare to empower, dare to empathize, dare to design. And for each chapter, I've then identified a subject matter expert or someone that, for me, holds an experience that really suits that chapter. And this person, chapter contributor, received, so just before summer, I wrote the skeleton of the book, and I wrote all the 30 sort of areas, and for each area there's 4 sort of subcategories, And I also wrote placeholder dares just to give them a little, like, not a blank sheet of paper. And, you know, in my essence, you know, if there's something in this dare that you like or that you've done previously, feel free to use and abuse my words if you want, or just delete them completely. So the collaboration has looked different for different people. Some will be working a lot tighter because their area is niched, and I'm sort of a generalist in that area. And in some, it's been more of a, well, you know, oh, didn't you do this thing? Why don't you write about that? So it's been more of a collaboration. So yeah, so the book is, it's full of these dares. And then I have also written double dares and triple dares for each chapter for the really daring. but it's kind of like, it's the book that I want all facilitators to have in their bathroom. It's the book that you want to just grab when you have a few minutes and right. get some insight or an idea. So yeah, that's sort of my aim.
Yeah.
My goal is for this to be in
coming to all you, just to a bathroom near
bathrooms.
You.
Exactly.
Wow. I love that. And can I become a facilitator?
Of course you can. Would you say that you're not a facilitator yet?
I've been in situations where I had to. Uh-huh. Just get a project going, mm-hmm. take the reins, assume that leadership position. Yep. I guess.
I think what's interesting is that facilitation doesn't have to be a role. Mm-hmm. It's a skill. So, you know, you can take leadership and apply facilitative leadership, which is completely different to authoritative leadership or any of the other ones that maybe isn't as nurturing towards group dynamics. Any meeting, gathering, conversation that you have can be facilitated. I mean, you notice quite quickly if it's not. And I would say, and this is actually not something that I bring up in the book, it's also very refreshing not to have facilitated meetings. You know, where is the serendipity? We do have a dare to improvise in it, which is also like a juxtapose. It's like, well, how much do you plan for to not plan, you know? One of the aims for this book is to reach sort of leaders and team leads in these big corps. Some of them are ingrained, they're good leaders. They have that sort of superpower already, but a lot of them don't. They haven't had the opportunity to, you know, work a lot with empathy or active listening, work a lot with, I mean, goodness, so many people don't know how to have meetings still to this day. It's just like, I'm gobsmacked that it's not better.
And two things I want to address about your book, and one is around the word dare, mm-hmm. because it is almost like a leap of faith, or it is, you know, you need courage. I think we're lacking courage in these days. I think I think that's why maybe children, as they play, they dare themselves, because they know that that will lead to greater things. And that's how we push the envelope. That's how we innovate. That's how mm-hmm. we evolve. So one of your youngest collaborators in your book.
Yeah.
Can you tell Henry. Me a little bit?
Yeah. Yeah. So apart from the main chapter collaborators in the book, I also have three sort of guest interviews that are more like truth interviews. Before Henry, I was planning to have, you know, I was thinking like, who are the bravest, most courageous, like within sports, like I should have an extreme athlete, you know, some like champion. And I was like, do you know what? One of the bravest people I know is 11 and his name is Henry and he's my nephew. And, you know, the fact that he started skiing when he was 3.5, and by 10 he won the Swedish junior championships in free ride skiing. It's like, of course I need to speak with him. And it's interesting what you're saying about how children, they package it as dares. But you know, I look at my daughter who's, you know, she's not even 2 yet, in the way that she climbs, you know, suddenly she's standing on a chair like, ta-da! It's like, what are you doing? Like, how did you dare to get up there? But they just do it. And unfortunately, I cannot claim this. This is Tottenham Hotspur's football club's motto, which is to dare is to do.
Wow.
Or is it to do is to dare? One of the two. So, but I'm using it all the time because in like for us adults, to dare is just to do. Just do it. Like and defining what it is that you're going to do. Of course, there's levels of difficulty, but just having the mindset of it doesn't have to be that scary as long as you break it down and just do something. Because it's a act on the way.
Wow. And the second aspect of your book is the fact that when we talk about belonging, and one of the roles of the facilitator is, because usually they're working either with very cohesive groups or sometimes it's a mixture of groups, they have to almost create belonging in their interventions and what they do. So what have you learned about that? Like how does belonging intercept the role of facilitation?
I think it's a great question. I was approached by a former student, this was a few years ago, because he was doing a dissertation on, this was prior to the pandemic, and he was doing a PhD, and he contacted me and they said, I would like to interview you. I was like, oh, about what? About psychological safety. I was kind of like, what's that? Not really, but yeah. In an essence, like, okay, that was before it became such a buzzword. And he said, because you're really good at creating a safe space. And I had never thought about that. That was just a given to me. And I think because, you know, everything from my background and always having to find myself in big groups of people, I've had to find belonging wherever I've gone. So when I'm in a space with a whole bunch of humans, it's natural to me to do my very best to make sure that they feel safe in that space and that they belong in that space. In my practice, I tend to say the smartest person in the room is the room. And there's loads of other sort of little analogies and ways of making everybody understand that the collective, the hive mind, is so much better than the individual one. And I think that has come across in the book. That's the whole point. It's like, this is, we're all thinking these things. It's not just one of us. And that creates a sense of belonging, that you have your voice heard and that you're also part of something greater. And from a sort of a leadership perspective, I'm hoping, like from the book, I'm doing a masterclass called Facilitative Leadership, where I look at the World Economics Skills on the Rise 2027. They've identified a list of 10 skills. Belonging isn't on there, but empathy is, and active listening is, and social influence is. So how can you as a leader facilitate your team in these areas and growing in these areas? And I think a facilitator, in terms of belonging, facilitation is key. Because that is someone with intent who is making sure that everybody is seen, heard, you know, feeling proud and connected and supported through whatever you're doing.
I think you're getting at, you're touching on something, one of the fundamental truths about belonging, which is you cannot actively go for it in the sense that it is it's more a result of everything.
Yes,
it's nothing that is completely tangible. And in many ways, there's an analogy to happiness. You know, there's all these now happiness researchers that are saying the moment you start like pursuing happiness and you go striving for happiness, that's when you get...
You won't have it.
Yeah, exactly. You will get more depressed, right? Because you're trying to arrive at this mythical place called happiness that doesn't really exist. But they forget that it's like the journey is you know, now we're getting into Buddhist philosophy, but it's... And so in many ways, these 10 skills, of course, belonging is not a skill either, but it's very, very clever. And it's almost like before we hit record, you were talking about how, oh, I didn't have a dare to belong. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, I think that's maybe that's why. Mm-hmm. And maybe belonging there's something about actively going for belonging that makes
works
it
works against you.
Exactly.
It's interesting because, I mean, is it the third or the fourth step on the Maslow hierarchy of needs?
Third.
So he's defined it as a need.
Yeah.
We're talking about it as being a feeling or a result. And I can see that, you know, his needs are things that people actively strive for. But yeah, in this case, it's definitely the result. And I mean, it is the result of inclusion. It's a result of
seeing other
empathy.
People.
It's a result of a lot of things.
Yeah. And creating the space, getting people who are different, not to be the same, but to embrace their differences in the same space. Mm. And I think your work definitely speaks to that. And
you can facilitate for belonging, though.
100%. 100%.
And I would say that a lot of the chapters in this book is more about that. It's not just like, dare to include. Include now.
Right. Yeah. We need 10% more inclusion, please.
Dare to be. Come on.
Yeah.
Be. but yeah, there's definitely a lot in there supporting belonging.
Yeah, and I think both in your work and your book, and I'm sure whatever you're going to come up with next, there's going to be an element of belonging there, because I think that's what you have been doing since childhood,
Well, I think also I've learned empathy and, you know, because it was a need that I had to. If I hadn't put in that sort of the social, cultural effort in doing those things, I would never have felt that I belonged. Unfortunately, you know, we all do things that maybe doesn't align with exactly with who we are to reach belonging. You know, going to these international schools, big focus on sports. I was in the varsity basketball and volleyball teams, but it wasn't any calling or passion. It was just like, if I want to be cool and belong and being in the gang, I need to be on a team. Which one shall I choose? But ironically, now when I look back at that, in basketball, I was the point guard, which is the person who facilitates the game.
Yes.
And in volleyball, I played the setter,
which
again, just setting it up for other people to smash. So, you know.
Yeah. Wow.
Look at that.
And
wow, and personal insights.
Yeah, and I think we went full circle. And we covered your journey from where you started, the red thread of belonging, the red thread of creativity. Besides, you know, of course, we're going to promote your book. We're going to help you get your book in the hands of not just facilitators out there, but anybody who aspires to tap into the value of facilitation, and especially not just in a business sense, but it could be in clubs and you know, any vocations.
Anywhere people gather, really.
Exactly. So, do you have any final dares, actually, for my audience or anything?
You're putting me on the spot.
We didn't plan for this question, but yeah.
So I have, there's actually four areas that I want to leave you with to sort of think about in your sort of journey to become a better facilitator. The first one is identifying what you are head over heels in love with. Daring to find that, dare to love, find that passion, because I don't know about you, but you know when you are newly in love with something, you dare to do a lot more. It's like, oh, you know, going on crazy dates and...
Yeah.
Yeah, so head over heels. The second one is just to get your hands dirty, like the whole doing, dare to do. Get them really, really, really dirty. Don't be afraid of
making mistakes.
Mistakes. Exactly.
Right.
I want you to... let your hair down, be creative, be flexible, have fun during the facilitation process. And the final one, which I would say kind of aligns best with belonging, is feel your heartbeat, the emotional intelligence of facilitation. You know, have a look, introspective look at, you know, is not so much about what's happening in the room, you know, how are we solving this problem, more this... is everyone coming to a safe space? is everyone being heard and supported? And how can I work on my own EQ to create the best belonging environment?
Wow, four dares. Jenny, that was amazing. I think there's nothing else to say except thank you.
thank you for
doing this. Thank you for coming on.
It was so much fun.
Yeah, and of course, we're going to have show notes and everything else. Thank you so much. Thank you for Create Belonging.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
And so we come to the end of episode 12 of Create Belonging. Again, thank you so much, Jenny, for taking the time to sit with us and to share your story. If you haven't already done so, please go ahead and check the show notes where you will find links to almost everything that we talked about, including links to where you can get yourself your copy of Dare to Facilitate. As I mentioned, the book is really beautiful, and I think we could all benefit from thinking of ourselves as facilitators when it comes to interacting with others. I also hope that you follow Jenny on LinkedIn, and I will have a list of her other socials as well. She is always providing value and interesting insights, so it's always great to connect with her. And before we go, I also want to say thank you for tuning in to this episode. Create Belonging is a labor of love. It is my passion. I'm on a mission to bring belonging to the forefront of people's conversations. I believe that if we can help ourselves and help others reconnect to our sense of belonging, I believe that eventually we will get to create a world where everybody feels like they belong. So thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you for subscribing to this podcast. If you have any feedback, I dare you to write to me or connect with me or let me know what you thought of this episode. I tend to answer to all your comments and all your emails. And if you have any suggestions on topics you want me to cover or any guest that you think would be worth having on the show, please let me know. I'm really easy to find. And so that's it. Before you go, I want to remind you to go create belonging for yourself and for others. Thank you. Bye.